You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Manuel tōku ingoa. Nau mai, hari mai, ki te Wire mō tēnā rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Emmanuel, and I'll be with you for the next hour. E whai akane, coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about his primary healthcare portfolio. Toby, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Professor Jennifer Frost about the recent wave of anti-Trump demonstrations in the United States and beyond.
And Theo, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Professor Terri-Anne Clark about the recent court findings against social media giants and the implications for Aotearoa New Zealand.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces today, so get in touch. Tuku patahi mai, text in on 5395. Kaua e wareware e ahai ana koutou, te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō. He pakehiri rokiroki mā runga i te pai, tukutuku i irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
About a month ago, we spoke to a researcher sounding the alarm over the state of our primary healthcare here and globally. You can find that at 95bfm.com. Across the globe, services meant to be the first port of call for health issues such as dentals, general practice, and pharmacists were found to be increasingly under stress as costs grow and workforces fail to keep pace with demands. Here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, the Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners Workforce Survey in 2022 raised concerns. Over half of GPs were planning to retire within the next decade. A declining number of GPs work in GP-run practices, and filling that gap is an increasing number of corporate healthcare providers. As the holder of the Green Party's primary healthcare portfolio, our Green Party interviewee is the perfect subject to discuss his party's platform on the subject. So for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, we talk primary healthcare, its current state here in Aotearoa, the issues it faces, and where the Green Party would like to take it.
Morena, Ricardo.
Morena, thanks for having me.
I want to use today to talk about one of your portfolios within the Green Party, the primary healthcare portfolio. There's a lot of coverage done within it in terms of preventative care, obviously, and general care. I want to start the conversation today by going across what primary healthcare covers for our listeners. For you, how do you conceptualize the portfolio and its responsibilities?
Yeah, so in politics, when politicians talk about health, often they're talking about hospitals and hospital infrastructure and the need to, you know, build new hospitals or adequately staff them, which is really, really important. But one of the things that we face as a country is that we've got people who show up to hospital for things that could have been treated earlier and could have been prevented. And this is where primary care, in my view, is. It covers a huge range of services, from public health organizations to, you know, like our pharmacies to GP services, community nurses, and you name it. And the idea is to work upstream to deal with things promptly and before people have to present to hospital in pain for something, like I said, that they could have had a pharmacist adequately recognize a minor ailment and prescribe something, or a GP that could have identified the care that people needed. Or, for example, even something as basic as treating a toothache or a cavity before somebody needs to show up to hospital with literally so much pain that they need just a tooth extraction. So that is the range of primary care, and we're very much committed to addressing that so that the focus isn't just on hospitals.
And with a portfolio like this, it's obviously as you say, very important for the idea of preventative care and not being just an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff, but also stopping people from falling off and the health issues from growing. But what issues do you see within New Zealand's primary health care? Is there issues? Is there not issues? Is it all going good?
Yeah, no, there are huge issues when it comes to accessing things like GP services and ensuring that our pharmacies are adequately resourced. One of the key things is obviously workforce, and particularly in rural areas, one of the ways that we fund our GP services at the moment does not account adequately for example, socioeconomic inequities or even health inequities along ethnicity lines. And the way that we fund, for example, our GP services has created the conditions where it's technically more profitable to set yourself up next to a wealthy retirement village than it is to set yourself up in an area that has a lot of low-income people who haven't had access to health services or where Pacifica and Māori have been historically underserved. But there's also issues around, for example, who owns these services. We're seeing corporate entities buying up pharmacies taking over pharmacies services as well as GP services. And these are not community models. These are not models that center the needs of the communities and instead put profit over people. So that's the other area that we're particularly concerned about.
Yes, on that topic, we did a Wire special on this a few weeks ago. People can check that out online if they want to. But we were talking to a GP who was worried that a lot of GPs now heading to that retirement age in the next 10 years, over 50% of the workforce is planning to retire, and we're not quite getting to that place of replacing them yet. And with that, there is this concern that given that they are all private practice anyway, that they might be taken over by sort of a corporate monopoly-ish healthcare situation, that could be a potential in our future. But what are the solutions for something like this?
Yeah, so in our green budget that we released this term, we have a vision where we can establish a community care service, basically providing free GP and our services, and starting with high needs area. And this will include support for a couple of Māori nonprofits and community providers, as well as also providing funding for low levels of GP services within mobile vans that can reach rural schools, marae, and other community centres. There's also the component and the reality of making sure that we further boost the uptake that our schools can take basically for placements of doctors. And I think this, alongside having a publicly owned and run model, is important to retain the workforce. Many GPs do not train to basically become small business owners. They train to provide healthcare. And right now, GPs are at a crossroads where many of them may find it easier to actually just let those clinics go corporate and have a corporation run the admin of it. And that risks our services being taken up by entities that do not put people ahead of profit. And we could end up having an even further Americanization of our healthcare system, where critical parts of our healthcare system are run by huge corporates. And this is why for us, you know, GP services and dental services have been a priority, because these are two entities that have not been properly, fully brought into the public healthcare system like many other parts of our healthcare system have historically.
Now, last electoral cycle, we saw a lot of promises being made around dental care. Should we expect to see more this time around?
You'll have to wait and see. We'll release our election announcements and our manifesto soon. But in a green budget, we were still committed to making dental care free. And you would have seen that, you know, several journalists have been covering issues where people are choosing to go overseas to get dental care or simply postpone it because they can't afford it. And the problem that we have is that people end up, again, presenting to the hospital with a huge amount of pain, and all they end up getting is an extraction, where we could have supported people to get annual checkups. And I recognize that it's not just as simple as sort of slapping a policy that says free dental care. It's about adequate boosting of our workforce. It's about starting those public services where the need is the highest, and also recognizing the need for mobile services as well as the funding that we provide to the under-18 services, which are already free, So the idea is to have a holistic policy package that can support people to access primary care.
All right. Now, moving into an area of innovation and how the government can help improve services, especially in that decentered model that we really have for healthcare in New Zealand. There's been lots of talk about a unified data forum, a space to share patients' health data in a way that can unify care across your dentist, your GP, your specialist in hospital. There's also been a lot of data breaches recently across different, not public health care data, but ones run through GPs.
Yeah.
What's your view on something like this?
Yeah, but the key thing here is that we need adequate resourcing to ensure that our data systems are safe, that we have the workforce that keeps ensuring that the software that is used is up to date and is well protected from security breaches. And one of the advantages of, for example, having a publicly owned model is that we also start creating the conditions for that to be managed with the public interest as opposed to leaving private companies completely take over the running of our cybersecurity. People's information on health is, as many will obviously know, extremely private and sensitive information often, as it may contain, you know, stuff that may relate to people's trauma, it may relate to issues around mental health, etc. So the key thing here is to adequately procure and resource the workforce that looks after this so that we don't see the security breaches, and I am concerned that this government isn't adequately prioritizing this.
And now, as we get to the end of the interview, I just want to spitball ideas at you and to see what you take to. There's an idea that came out of Costa Rica of effective healthcare provision from like a nurse type role that would support a network of healthcare providers and a hub. So you'd have your dentist, your specialist, your GP, all of that would work in one place. And then these people would go out to the community, they would triage them, take down their problems, and then take those back to the specialists and streamline the process there. Could you see something like that happening in Aotearoa, New Zealand?
I think there are some communities that already have this triage model, and a lot of it relies on public health organizations being able to be resourced and mandated to do this. And so, yes, we would, of course, support that work happening in the community. Ultimately, I think a lot of the work on prevention relies on having healthcare workers that are resourced, adequately paid, and that would have enough to be in the community to connect people with health services. You know, when I've been out to South Auckland, the issues that people report to me is that, you know, we've got families who haven't gone to a GP in years, potentially decades, just simply because there is that lack of trust, that lack of connection, that lack of a relationship with healthcare workers. And so absolutely support greater investment in ensuring that we have people out in the community connecting people and signing them up to their GPs as well.
All right, Ricardo, this is our time. Thank you very, very much for talking to me this morning.
Thank you so much, Manuel.
That was Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March on primary healthcare here in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
Gentlemen, this is Democracy Manifest.
The Wire.
This is A Lizard State by King Cruel. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Sunny days, gonna keep me outside right on the shade. You're gonna keep me outside right on the shade. It's gonna be like this, and that's right, that's okay. Is that okay? Myself and PT is lying to me, and I'm dead tired of the shit you call this fucking bitch. You don't know when to stop. You're launching fat bitches, motherfucking fat bitches. Ah, why don't it be trapped in the black of your heart? How could a fuck think so fucked? Cause that's a start. But if I can't have it, then no one can. Oh, baby, what am I to do?
giving up on loving you. Why don't it's not nothing new? So please do I ask you to? And please do I want a few? It's just not fair, baby blue girl, it's true. One day I'm gonna have you, but for now I could do. Well, I got everyone in my back, but I'm not gonna crack like you cracked. You're a fucking pussy boy. Whoa, whoa, sipping up on my homie pie. You got all lens grin in my height. Don't try and get near my height. Don't try and get out of the way. I see what you gotta say. I hate your interstate. If that's okay, if that's not okay, is it gonna what's okay? Why don't we be trapped in the back of your heart? And now I'm gonna make it clear and girl, I'll tear you apart from the inside to the out. Girls, I supposed to do. Yeah, I was so up on loving you. And girl, believe me, this is something new. Cause all I will do is go whatever I have to do. Well, they all knife me in the back. And girl, I can't believe it's slipping away like that.
Think of a number divided by two. Something is nothing. Nothing is nothing. Tear off the lid, then think of a number. Don't think of an answer. Open your eyes, think of a number. Don't get slipped under. A number's a number. A chance encounter you want to avoid. The inevitable. So you know. Oh yes, you know. The impossible. Now you ain't got a number, you just want a rumba. And there ain't no way you're gonna go under. Go under, go under. Go under, go under. You tear me asunder. Go under, go under. Go under, yeah.
Some spice to your existential crises with the new Robin record, Sexistential. It's so good, we've made it our album of the week. And that means if you have a B card, you can win a copy on 95BFM Breakfast all week. Just tune in for your cue to enter. Sexistential, the new album from Robin. Available Friday, March 27th, wherever fine music is sold.
Okay, Meadow, we can't lose again, or it's off to the factory. Go, Meadow! Go!
No, other way! Don't you want to live?
Gonna get there, good horse! Headway wins the Spring Cup!
Oh no, Meadow.
I won't let them take you, Meadow. We'll find a way. I just saw a documentary about a basketball-playing Labrador. Maybe you can learn an unconventional sport too.
Pony Ping Pong with Matt and Aaron, bringing as much entertainment to your Friday night as a Shetland pony skee-balling the table edge. With a mix of mashdowns, candid conversation, cheap shots, and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong, Friday, 9 till 11 p.m., only on 95 BFM.
The worms better watch their back.
Sometimes you need a bit of uns.
That snooze button better be disarmed.
I like it. It's making my eyelid twitch. Love it.
And the wrong side of the bed better shuffle over.
And they're just so beautifully, like, menstrual.
Because we've got a little something for your gratitude journal.
Cowbella.
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 It's the 95 BFM Breakfast Show with your hosts, Rosetta and Millie. 7 till 10 every weekday. Thanks to 8:30 Coffee Roasters.
I don't want you monkey mouth motherfucker sitting in my throne again. I'm mad, but I ain't stressing. True friends, one question. Bitch, where you and I was walking? Now I run a game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta, everybody wanna cut the legs off him. Kunta, black man taking no losses.
Oh, yeah.
Bitch, where you and I was walking? Now I run the game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta, everybody wanna cut the legs off him. When you got the yams,
what's the yams?
The yam is the power that beat. You can smell it when I'm walking down the street.
Oh yes we can, oh yes we can.
I can dig rapping, but a rapper with a ghost rider. What the fuck happened?
Oh no,
I swore I wouldn't tell. But most of y'all share bars like you got to buy the bunk in a two-man sale.
A two-man sale.
Something's in the water.
Something's in the water.
And if I got a brown nose for some gold, then I'd rather be a bum than a motherfucking bum.
Oh, yeah.
Bitch, where you and I was walking. Now I run the game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta, everybody wanna cut the legs off.
King Kunta,
black man taking no losses.
Oh, yeah.
Bitch, where you and I was walking. Now I run the game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta, everybody wanna cut the legs off. The yam brought it out of Richard Pryor.
Pryor, 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 Pryor.
Manipulated Bill Clinton with desires. 24/7, 365 days times two. I was contemplating getting off stage just to go back to the hood, see my enemy and say,
oh, yeah.
Bitch, where you and I was walking. Now I run the game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta, everybody wanna cut the legs off.
King Kunta,
black man taking no losses.
Oh, yeah.
Bitch, where you and I was walking. Now I run the game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta,
goat mouth mammy fucker.
I was gonna kill a couple rappers, but they did it to themselves. Everybody's suicidal, they didn't even need my help. This shit is elementary, I'd probably go to jail. If I shoot at your identity and bounce to the left, stuck a flag in my city. Everybody's screaming Compton, I should probably run from mayor when I'm done. To be honest, and I put that on my mama and my baby boo too. 20 million walking out the court, Betty, woo woo. Oh yeah, fuck the judge, I made it past 25. And now I was a little nappy-headed nigga with the world behind him. Life ain't shit but a fat vagina. Screaming, Annie, are you okay? Annie, are you okay? Limo tinted with a gold plate. Straight from the bottom, it's the belly of the beast. From a peasant to a prince to a motherfucking king.
Oh yeah?
Bitch, where you and I was.
By the time you hear the next pop, the funk shall be within you.
Now I run the game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta, everybody wanna cut the legs off.
King Kunta,
black man taking no losses.
Oh yeah?
Bitch, where you and I was walking. Now I run the game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta, everybody wanna cut the legs off.
Take it.
remember you was conflicted.
Welcome back to The Wire. That was King Kunta by Kendrick Lamar, and before that was Three Girl Rumba by Wire.
That is the result of His Majesty's in government.
You're listening to The Wire.
This July, the United States of America will celebrate 250 years since the Declaration of Independence, when the original 13 colonies broke away from the British Empire under King George III. Recently, however, millions of Americans have taken to the streets to voice their disapproval of a man they see as a new monarchical figure, President Donald J. Trump. The original No Kings protests were held on the 14th of June last year to coincide with Donald Trump's birthday military parade. The most recent round of demonstrations occurred last weekend and drew an estimated 8 million people, united by the belief that the president must respect the boundaries of his office. This morning I spoke to Jennifer Frost, Professor of History at the University of Auckland and Chairperson of the New Zealand Chapter of Democrats Abroad, about the significance of these demonstrations in the context of American history. President Donald Trump certainly seems to enjoy playing into this association with monarchy. Last year he tweeted a quote attributed to Emperor Napoleon, "He who saves his country does not violate any law." Around that same time he tweeted, "Long live the king," in celebration of his administration's successful effort to halt congestion pricing tolls in New York City. He also seems to be a massive admirer of the British royal family, reveling in every invitation he gets to meet the king. So do you think that Trump's interest in monarchy is little more than a superficial love of glamorous gilded palaces, or do you believe he actually has aspirations to overturn the American system of government and rule as something closer to a monarch?
Yes, I think both. He definitely likes all the trappings of monarchy, and as we have seen with the White House and even Washington, D.C., how he's been remaking the architecture and the decorations, you know, more and more gilt, more and more gold, you know, more and more fancy trappings. And so he certainly loves that, and he loves the motorcades, and he loves all the attention, et cetera. But at the same time, he and the people behind him believe in a legal theory within the United States about what's called the unitary executive. And it really is concentrating even more power in the hands of the executive branch in the White House. And on top of that, the Supreme Court in 2024 gave Trump almost total immunity for anything he does in office, which is very king-like. In fact, it's more power than King Charles has, in Great Britain.
So is this unitary executive theory, does it have an actual constitutional foundation?
No, we would say no. So legal critics would say, no, it doesn't. And the whole premise of the U.S. Constitution was to balance power among the executive, the legislative, and the judicial branch. And in fact, not to have so much power, you know, monarchical power in the hands of the executive. And again, the United States or the colonies fought a revolution against a king and monarchy and sought to establish a republic in which the people have sovereignty, have the authority and govern to rule. So the entire premise for us as historians and for most legal scholars would be absolutely the unitary executive theory is bunk. But there are legal scholars who are conservative who are pushing this, and there are members of the Supreme Court who push this, and certainly there are people in the current Trump regime who support this.
While the No Kings protests were happening in the States, parallel protests were also held in up to 20 foreign countries as a show of solidarity. However, in constitutional monarchies like the United Kingdom and Canada, the slogan had to be changed from No Kings to No Tyrants or No Dictators in order to avoid confusion. Obviously, we live in a country which technically still has a monarch, and the word king is not necessarily a dirty word to the same degree that it is in the States, where the opposition to monarchy is baked into the founding story of the nation. In 2026, as we approach the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, how much does that founding revolutionary story still shape the way Americans think about their special, unique nation?
Yes, I think it really is still very important. And you're absolutely right about the, what do you call your protest? So we had our first protest in this vein in last weekend in Auckland, and we called it No Tyrants. And that was the decision of a group I'm part of called Democrats Abroad, which really focuses on getting out the vote from Americans living abroad. And obviously, these we're not going to have a no kings when King Charles is much preferred over Trump. I have to say, for most of us, and there's more limits on what Charles can do, obviously, with the Parliament, et cetera. So, but I think it is the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence and the American Revolution. And one of the really important things that's been happening, especially with the No Kings, No Tyrants protest, is taking back American patriotism, taking back the flag, taking back we the people, right? That has sort of been the really territory of the right for decades now. And one of the things that the kind of liberal left moderate has been really pushing is we are just as patriotic and believe in the ideals of the United States, and we need to reclaim the symbols, the language, the arguments of that era.
Yes, this is a very sensitive question, obviously, but do you think that maybe the liberal left in America, one of the reasons why they failed is that they have been scared about tapping into a kind of traditional American patriotism?
I think part of the problem for us, and actually I even feel this way teaching U.S. history, is, we don't have a simple argument. So we have, let's be very critical of both the historical injustices of the United States, from slavery to land theft to genocide, and let's be honest and forthright about that. At the same time, can we appreciate the historic significance and celebrate the values of the ideals of the United States, the best of what the United States stood for? So it's just a more challenging argument to make.
So going back to this comparison between 1776 and 2026, the Revolutionary War was obviously a very bloody affair, but one of the important features of the recent No Kings protests is their commitment to nonviolence. Indeed, the last round of protests has been called the largest nonviolent demonstration in US history. As a historian, do you think that nonviolent protests have the potential to create real change? And if so, what would you say is the most recent comparable example in American history?
I think what's so important about nonviolence in this moment, as well as it was in the civil rights movement and other movements, is especially when you're going up against a violent regime, right, that's trying to achieve its aims through violence, to be giving a counterexample of seeking change, pursuing change through nonviolence, I think that's really powerful. And the other thing is the goal of these movements and protests is, connecting people, and really people have been talking about the joy, and I know for us in Auckland, it was a joy to see people. People are bringing their signs, their costumes, the creativity, the humor. It all challenges the grim hostility of this authoritarian Trump regime and gives us a different vision of what our world could be.
Now, is there a point where things get so bad that it's time to bring out the guillotine?
Well, I know that, things are bad, right? War crimes are being committed. Crimes are being committed against people in detention. People are losing their lives, in the streets, in the Caribbean. It is as grim and bleak as it could be. And yes, that is one of the things that people are talking about, is there tends to be in the United States this sort of forgive and forget, let's move on. When Richard M. Nixon committed crimes, he was pardoned by his successor, Gerald Ford. Obama, when he came in 2009, after winning in 2008, everybody thought he was going to close Guantanamo, and he was going to, try members of the Bush administration for war crimes. None of that happened. Even the Biden administration didn't go strongly enough after Trump, I would say, and his ilk. And so that, a lot of people are calling for that. That can't be how it is, that we need some sort of truth and reconciliation process, that we really need to confront and expose and be transparent about all the crimes, all the corruption that's happening, if we're going to get someplace different. And I think one of the things that everybody's calling for is not just restoration of what came before Trump, but really a reconstruction. We can't just restore the democracy or the political system, the economic system that brought us to this place. That's not going to get us any place different, right? That's going to be just as fragile and uncertain as where we are now. And so there really has to be a much greater vision of where we're going and true reconstruction. And to get that started, this kind of truth and reconciliation process would be very important. I was just reading an article this morning about something like 12 or so of the January Sixers that had been convicted and were in jail for their crimes on January 6, 2021. You know, Trump pardoned them all the first day he was inaugurated, and 12 of them are already back in prison for absolutely horrific crimes, right? And the thing is, this regime with the pardons that have happened, all the corruption, it's like giving carte blanche to anybody who is a criminal. And, you know, really, of course, violating the rule of law and ignoring the rule of law. And that has to get reestablished somehow. It's going to take somebody in leadership and an administration in leadership and a party in leadership that is trying to make change at the same time. You can't be so punitive that you just destroy everything in its wake. It's so, again, it's a more complicated task, right? Because the goal really is to bring everybody into some sort of coalition and move forward. Otherwise, we're really in trouble.
That was Professor Jennifer Frost from the University of Auckland. And this is Rock the Casbah by The Clash.
Shaking to the top. The shaking tool is Cadillac. in the mix with DJ Farmer's Market. This call is gonna get a nice gift certificate to Whole Foods.
Come on.
That was Play Me by Kim Gordon, and before that was Rock the Casbah by The Clash. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879. Last week, courts in the US found that Meta and YouTube were responsible for the childhood addiction and mental health issues of a woman known as KGM, awarding $6 million USD, or $10.4 million in New Zealand dollars, in damages. Meanwhile, in New Mexico, Meta was fined $375 million USD, or $650 million New Zealand dollars, for endangering children. Internationally, countries are increasingly coming to reckon with the effects of social media. Australia, which last year banned under-16-year-olds from accessing social media, is pursuing further potential legal action against the social media giants, while debates around a similar ban in Aotearoa New Zealand continue to polarise. However, in the light of the harms posed by social media, a ban is not the only solution that has been proposed. To speak to us on some of these alternative approaches, I was joined by Professor Terri-Ann Clark of the University of Auckland School of Nursing. Kia ora, Professor Terri-Ann Clark. So, starting off, we've seen recent cases in the US where a jury in Los Angeles found YouTube, which is owned by Google's parent company Alphabet, and Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, responsible for childhood addiction and mental health issues. They've awarded $6 million USD in damages. Now, we've also seen a case recently in New Mexico, which found Meta liable for its platforms endangering children, awarding over $300 million USD in cases. Can you walk us through briefly the implications of this news for us? Is this good news?
Well, I think it just reassures and affirms what a lot of us have thought for a while, you know, that actually many of these companies have been deliberately targeting and marketing and producing content that actually can be really harmful to children and young people.
Yeah, so on the flip side of that kind of decision, we've also seen recently cases like in Australia, which have advocated for or have pursued a complete ban of social media for children under the ages of 16. Now, recently, it's been announced that they're actually pursuing even more court action against the big tech companies because they've failed to ban these under 16-year-olds from their platforms properly. Does this kind of illustrate issues with pursuing complete bans? I mean, what's the kind of middle ground between these approaches, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, like, what I think's useful about these court actions are that they're, you know, putting a line in the sand and saying, actually, this is harmful for our children. And actually, it's your responsibility to design content that is safe, that is not going to harm our children. And the ways that we leverage that isn't necessarily around total bans, right? Because social media is part of our world, and it's how young people keep in contact, it's how they engage with the world, it's how they find out information, it's how adults do that. And to kind of completely ban young people, I think, shuts off all the really good things as well as the really negative things. So, you know, I actually think that a social media ban is not a great idea. I think that it's a really blunt instrument for a much bigger issue. It sort of just sticks a sticking plaster on a gaping wound. And I think, you know, actually there are far smarter ways that we could go about doing this.
So what are some of these smarter ways that we could go about it? And would we be able to, I guess, trust the companies that control these platforms to pursue these solutions as well?
Oh, look, I don't think it's in their best interests to create content that that isn't addictive, that doesn't market to young people, because that's how they make their money. But, you know, we've, over many years, put in a whole bunch of legislations that protect children in Aotearoa, for instance. So we can't market alcohol and tobacco to children. We can't have marketing on television where we know that in times that we know that children are going to be on TV, you know, watching TV. So there's a whole range of strategies that, you know, kind of public health strategies that we know limit young people's access.
Okay, so leaning into that more regulation rather than prohibition stance, what are some solutions that we could maybe look for?
So I think that there are a range of things that we can engage in. So I think, first of all, we have to hold the megas and the giants accountable for their content. And this is a global action that needs to happen. I think if little old New Zealand goes in there and says, you can't do that anymore, I think we would have limited leverage, I guess. But actually, if everyone gets together, if all of the nations say this is unacceptable, you cannot target our children and young people like this, I think we've got far more power to be able to influence at that level. I also think there's a range of strategies at the New Zealand legislative level. So there's the Harmful Communications Act. There is a range of you know, sort of solutions that we could put in at a local level. Interestingly enough, Australia's having, you know, a fair amount of difficulty with the age verification of young people. And so, you know, we do have to think more creatively about how we, you know, support young people to engage online and have access to, you know, appropriate content. But also, you know, one of the things from my perspective is that actually young people's first help seeking is done via, you know, Google or ChatGPT, or, you know, young people are seeking solutions online. And if we cut off that lifeline, we actually could be, you know, creating more harm by, you know, reducing young people's access to support. These are digital natives. They are much smarter than us at figuring out ways around systems. Well, much smarter than me anyway. And, you know, just an example of that, my son, who at the time I think was only about 8, had figured out that if he put in the time zone for Perth, Australia, that he could get 4 more hours on his laptop. And, you know, I was kind of like, how is he getting around these controls that I'm putting on for my children? So even when you think that you're putting in all these foundations and all these strategies to keep our children, maybe minimize their time online or make sure that they go to bed and things like that, they find ways around it. So I do think that we have to be much smarter around making sure that we that the content is safe, that we are looking at levers to minimise the harm, and you know, maybe get people out and talking to real humans again, and doing stuff that children do, which I think is really important. I also think, from a mental health perspective, there's some really, you know, you know, we've got a lot of anxious young people who don't really know how to make friends now. And so, you know, leveraging online spaces for young people to connect is really just one of the strategies. But we sort of need to figure out how to create this real life and online presence in balance, really. One of the other things that I think is really important is that, you know, then young people aren't going to magically figure out how to be responsible digital citizens at the age of 16. You know, actually, this is an incremental thing. We have to teach children how to incrementally, just like we sort of teach young people how to drive. You don't just kind of throw them the keys when they're 16 and go, off you go. There's a whole range of things that we can do that sort of graduate young people into more independence and abilities to negotiate content by themselves.
Professor Terri-Anne Clark, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Professor Terri-Anne Clark from the University of Auckland School of Nursing on the recent social media court cases in the US, the need for international collaboration and domestic regulation of social media platforms. This is Somebody Pay Nina by One Tablespoon and Nina Duraci.
It's okay, just another day. Feel what I love. The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa e kōrero mai ki te matou mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap for The Wire on Rapa Wednesday. Thank you to all of our guests, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, the University of Auckland's Associate Professor Jennifer Frost, and University of Auckland's Professor Tyrianne Clark. Nei rā hukitia mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Bridge.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.